And so in Pentateuch, we're in Deuteronomy starting chapter 15. And I'll remind you, this is part of a section that a number of people had said continues the idea of the Sabbath and says a bit more about that. So we looked at holy days and the second tithe that applies to them. And as we go into chapter 15, I'll remind you, this seems to correspond to the command that we see mentioned in Exodus 21, verse 2, saying that slaves that are Hebrews must be released after 6 years of service. 6 years of service, then in the seventh they go free. We'll also see a correspondence with the land Sabbath that is every 7 years. Yes? Exodus 21, 2 for the servants. And Exodus 23, verse 11 discusses the land Sabbath. That was Exodus 23, 11. And also in Leviticus 25, verses 2 through 4. So I'm throwing a lot of scriptures at you early on. Leviticus 25, 2 through 4. Remember, the land Sabbath also gets tied into the Jubilee year. So every seventh year, the land rests. But after, you know, 49th year, which would be a land Sabbath, then the 50th year is an additional land Sabbath, when all land would revert back to its original owners, servants would go free. It's a big deal. Although it's a big deal that we don't know how often, if ever, the Israelites actually practiced. But we'll get into that and actually some of the intention here. Starting in verse 1, at the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release of debts. This is the form of release. Yeah? Any creditor who's lent anything to his neighbor shall release it. He won't require it. There's room to question if the release of servants is on the same schedule as the land Sabbath. We haven't got to that yet. Right now it's talking about releasing debts. But remember, a servant, you know, whenever you're sold into servitude, there's a duration of time. So that would start when they're sold into service. The land Sabbath was on a set schedule. And I'm bringing it up because there's sort of a question, were they made to coincide or not necessarily? And the other thing about this saying every seventh year release the debt, there's some discussion among scholars of the Hebrew. Some say that it didn't mean the entire debt is canceled. Like if I have a mortgage on my house, I take out a 30-year mortgage, but during the seventh year, it's all gone. I don't have to pay. That wouldn't sound like a very good deal to the lender. Some people say that what it means is during that seventh year, no payments had to be made, but they would resume on the eighth year. And again, that's speculation. We can't go back and ask Moses, now, which did you mean in this case? And fortunately, you know, we don't have to worry about it because it was part of the civil law for the nation, not one that we see as a moral law upon Christians. So, you know, I've had questions on whether, as I said, is the debt entirely released or is it just suspended during the seventh year and then resumes? You know, I've studied it, I didn't find that entirely plausible, but there's no way to disprove it either. And as I said, it's not something we have to worry too much about. I think it's important for you to be aware that there is that theory. Moving on, now there's a difference in verse 3, of a foreigner you may require it. You shall not give up your claim to what is owed, but you shall give up your claim to what is owed by your brother. So as part of Israel's civil law, it applied to Israelites, but not to citizens of other nations. That's another thing that tells us, okay, this isn't like the Ten Commandments that is God's intention for all people everywhere. This is something for the workings of their particular nation. And verse 4 has caused some question. Except when there be no poor among you. It sounds like, okay, this law is in place, but if suddenly there's no poor, then you don't have to worry about it. I shouldn't say suddenly, but many scholars say really it has a different meaning. Instead of except when there be no poor, some say that it should be translated that there be no poor. So you're doing this so you don't have people ultimately poor. I like the New Living Bible. Its translation says no one will become poor because of this. You might say, what does that mean? Well, the idea is by having this year of release and, you know, making sure that land will go back to its owners, people can't be in debt forever, It's intended to prevent people from getting so over-obligated they can never get out. If you've ever studied American history, shortly after the Civil War, they developed what's called the sharecropping system. And what happened is, you know, people would sharecrop and they'd borrow from the landowner, pay back a share of their crop, and those who had control of the system set it up so people could never get out of debt. Matter of fact, there's some, if you've ever heard the old Tennessee Ernie Ford song about 16 tons, you load 16 tons, what do you get? Some of you are nodding. And part of that is, I sold my soul to the company store. The idea is if you live in a company town, you have to buy from that store. They can raise the prices, you know, so that you can't afford to pay off your debt. You're perpetually in debt. God's system is to avoid that. The idea is no one gets perpetually in debt. Now, do we have anything in our current legal system to try to alleviate that problem? Yes. Okay, bankruptcy laws are set up for that. So in modern day, we have a different system. You could argue back and forth as to which would be more effective, but the system God gave for Israel, I don't know if it's ever been tried in modern times. We would say, though, obedience to God's laws would do well to prevent poverty. But as I said, unfortunately, we don't know if any nation has ever continued in them long enough. And there's indication, let me give you a couple of scriptures to show that you'd have poor. One is later in this chapter. You know, in chapter 15, verse 11, it says, the poor will never cease from the land. God could say that because he knows human beings. He knows human nature. There's always going to be some poor people. And Jesus Christ said something similar in Matthew 26, verse 11. Matthew 26, 11, he said, "For you have the poor with you always." Now, in that particular case, I'll be right with you. That's when, remember, the woman broke the alabaster flask and used that very expensive ointment to anoint his feet. And some of the disciples were saying, why didn't they sell this and give to the poor? Jesus said, well, you're always going to have poor people, but I'm not going to be here for very long. But it did include the statement that seems to support the idea there's always going to be some poor people. Sorry, Nate? It was in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 15:11. So just later on in this particular chapter. And that supports the idea that here in verse 4 should be translated differently than the King James has it. Because here it says, except when there be no poor, and later it says, well, there's always going to be poor. Why would you make an exception? So the translation that says this is intended to prevent people becoming poor is a better meaning. Okay, so anyways, it goes on. The next several verses making the case, yeah, you want to do this to try to keep people from being poor. God is taking care of you. Now we'll skip down to verse 7. It says, if there is among you a poor man of your brethren within any of your gates in your land, which the Lord your God is giving you, don't harden your heart or shut your hand from your poor brother. Open your hand wide. I love the symbolisms. Open your hand. In other words, be willing to give or even to loan. Lend him sufficient for his needs, whatever he needs. But beware, lest there be a wicked thought in your heart saying, seventh year release is coming up soon, and your eye be evil. It's like, it's the sixth year. If I loan him, he's not going to have to pay me back, so I'm not going to make a loan. He's saying, don't think about it that way. You know, your poor brother might cry out to the Lord against you, it becomes sin. Verse 10 says, you shall surely give him, and your heart should not be grieved when you give to him, for this thing, the Lord your God will bless you. So you do this, God will take care of you. And that's where it says, the poor will never cease from the land. Therefore, I'm telling you, open your hand wide. What this is saying is, base your willingness to lend to a poor person on two things, I would say. One, his need, and two, your ability. You know, because basically, if I'm going to be poor and hungry, I should, you know, by giving to him, it doesn't mean I should do that so he has enough and I don't have any. So it's based on your ability, but also on his need, but certainly not on when the seventh year of release is and when he'll be able to pay you back. Now, is there a reciprocal of that someone who needs to borrow should keep in mind? If it's saying, say, Andrew needs $40 to get some groceries for this week, and I say, he might not ever be able to pay me back, I'm not going to lend him $40. You know, and this is saying, no, Frank, you don't base it on whether or not he can pay you back because of the year of release. Does that law apply to how Andrew would look at asking me to loan him? In what way? Well, let's see if Kayla. What I'm getting is like, oh, the seventh year of release is coming. I'm going to borrow a bunch that I won't have to pay back. You know, the same thing. No, don't think that way. Have good intentions. If only ask to borrow if you have a real need, not just because you can work the system and not have to pay it back. You know, the same thing would be, say you know you're going to file bankruptcy, so you go out and run up all your credit cards to the limit. That's not really a godly attitude. That's not what he has in mind, you know, when someone's released from debt. I would say a good guideline then is if I'm deciding whether or not to lend to someone and I think, he might not repay me, but I still have the ability, well, don't make it a loan. Make it a gift. You know, maybe I say Andrew needs 40 bucks. He's going to go hungry. I got plenty of money, which I don't, but I could loan someone 40 bucks. You know, and I know he might not be able to repay me. Well, if I can afford it, just make it a gift. Now, that's Frank Dunkel's advice, not something that it says here specifically in Deuteronomy. And I'm not implying that Andrew's poor, by the way. My eye fell on him. Yeah, Nate? Yeah, that's a good point. I wasn't even addressing, you know, this. I've been making the assumption that you know them and you know the need and that it's valid. Yeah, someone you don't know and you think, yeah, they tell me I'm starving, but really they just want to go buy marijuana. You know, you don't need to give them money based on that. So, yeah. And sometimes, yeah, someone says they're hungry, give them food rather than money. But, yeah, that we could go on a long time with that. So let's come back here unless anyone has other questions. In verse, 12? Yeah, if your brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, has sold you and served 6 years. So now we're not talking about debt. We're moving on to releasing a servant. When you send him away free from you, don't send him away empty-handed. You shall supply him liberally from your flock and your threshing floor, from your wine press, from what God has blessed you. And he reminds you, you were a slave. You know what this is about. This is repeating, again, Exodus 21:12. I mentioned that earlier. Now, I'm wondering, at the start of the chapter, I said Exodus 21, verse 2, and that might have been a typo, because here I've got 21:12. Does anyone have their Bible open to Exodus 21? Okay, so maybe 12 is a mistake. Well,
12 says he who strikes a man who dies shall surely be put to death.
Oh, okay, so this should be 2. So that's a typo here. Okay, this is supporting the idea of releasing the servant after 6 years, and the idea that it's not necessarily tied to the land Sabbath. We're addressing them both in the same chapter, but it doesn't say, it's not saying the same with debt. Oh, the time of release is coming up, so I'm not going to take this guy into service. That seems to be for a set period, I think. Well, one thing is interesting. It's saying this servant is valuable to you. Matter of fact, verse 18 says, it won't seem hard to you when you send him away free. He's been worth a double hired servant serving to you. Okay, this is implying that someone who's doing this is a good servant. And it's making the point, though, don't say, okay, I've fulfilled my duty, I made you work like a dog, and now walk out, you know, with only the clothes on your back. God is saying he came to you because he was destitute and he couldn't pay and all that. He's been working hard for you. Make sure when he goes, you give him supplies. Make sure he can start taking care of himself. Maybe give him farming tools and some seed and things like that. And don't feel bad about it. He's earned it. And I mentioned this earlier when it came up in Exodus, that I think this system is designed to help the poor become self-sufficient rather than continually dependent. So unlike our welfare system, which at times we make efforts to try to make sure people are working and getting educated, here the idea is if, you know, I'm just inept at managing my affairs and farming and such, and so I've got debts, I can't pay them off, I have to sell myself into servitude. Say I sell myself to Tim. Tim's a successful businessman. I'm going to go work for him, and maybe I can watch how he does things, and I can learn to be successful too, so that when I'm free, I don't fall into the same cycle. So the idea is those who have the money to buy someone who's poor must know how to manage their money, and hopefully the poor person will learn that trade too. So it doesn't say that explicitly, but it seems to be implied that that could happen, and I would say should. So having said that, I want to move on to verse 19. Here is a reminder that God has a claim on all the people in Israel and all their livestock, and he claims the firstborn. All the firstborn males that come from your herd of your flock, sanctify the Lord your God. Don't work with them. Don't shear the firstborn of your flock. You and your household shall eat it before the Eternal, your God, in the place which he chooses. So by eat it, it means you can go and make like a thank offering, a peace offering, so you get to eat some of it. It's not a burnt offering or sin offering, but it belongs to God. So you know, remember going all the way back to the Passover, when God went through Egypt and killed all the firstborn, but he protected the Israelites who had the blood on their doorpost. But God said, okay, I didn't kill the firstborn, but they belong to me. They're sanctified to me. And so this is a reminder of that. Oh, but verse 21, it reminds you, if it's a defect, you know, it's lame or blind, don't sacrifice it. Don't make it part of the sacrificial system if it's not pure, if it's not healthy. But you can kill it in your own household. You still don't get to keep it and use it as a work animal. It still has to be killed, but you can eat it at home, just like a deer or a gazelle, as it says. And again, this is something that, you know, was part of the ritual system that we don't practice today. So if your dog has puppies, you don't have to, well, I'm trying to devote the firstborn. You wouldn't have to kill it and eat it because we don't do that. But, okay, sorry, I'm getting off track. Well, like Connor is my firstborn son. According to ritual law, I would redeem him with an animal instead. But I didn't have to do that. But I did thank God very much that I had a firstborn. And an only born in our case. So moving on, questions, thoughts? Okay, chapter 16. Observe the month of Abib and keep the Passover to the Lord your God in the month Abib. Unlike Leviticus 23, we're going to notice Deuteronomy 16 mentions the holy day seasons, but it doesn't give specific instructions for each holy day. This is more of a general overview. And by the way, Abib, or some people pronounce it Abib, means green ears, or some would translate it tender ears. Not ears like on your head, but kernels of grain, like ears of corn. So it basically means the month when the crops aren't quite ripe, but they're getting close. And the official name of the month later on, it became known as Nisan, N-I-S-A-N. And you see that, the first month, or the month of Nisan, sometimes it's called Abib. How is the month of Abib observed? Well, as it says here, by keeping the Passover and by implication also the days of unleavened bread, as we'll see described. In verse 2, sacrifice the Passover to the Lord your God from the flock in the place where the Lord chooses to put his name. This will be an important thing. But also you shall eat no leavened bread with it. 7 days eat unleavened bread. That's the bread of affliction. Why is it called the bread of affliction? Well, you guys just had it. What do you think of dry matzos? You know, were you ready to have some rolls and sourdough bread and stuff? So it's not like it kills you to eat it, but it's just not as good. I mean, God made, well, some people really like it. Well, there's the thing. It takes a lot of butter to make matzos. Butter and salt and maybe some onion and otherwise, plain without it, it's not as good. And I'm just getting it. That's the meaning of bread of affliction. It's not as pleasant as a nice puffy roll, perhaps, which we don't do during the days of unleavened bread, but we do now. So verse 4, no leaven shall be seen among you in all your territory for 7 days, nor shall any meat you sacrifice, any of the meat you sacrifice at the first day at twilight remain over till morning. That last part of verse 4 is a reminder that the lamb that was sacrificed for Passover, you couldn't keep over and eat. You know, you ate what you ate, and then all the rest would be burned up. It's a one-time, one-use-only sacrifice. So this is reminding us there's different symbolism. The Passover focuses on the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. They didn't understand about the Messiah yet, but they would. The Days of Unleavened Bread emphasizes putting leaven out, which symbolizes sin, and also taking in the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Or we also make the association with Jesus Christ as the bread of life. If you remember, John chapter 6 is a long story about Christ explaining that. So, and I won't elaborate further here. Let's go on in verse 5. You may not sacrifice Passover within any of your gates, which the Lord your God gives you. But at the place where the Lord your God chooses to place his name, there sacrifice the Passover at twilight, at the going down of the sun, the time you came out of Egypt. Again, this is a reminder, you know, that particular Hebrew phrase that literally means between the evenings. And we say, you know, the day begins precisely at sundown, but it's not totally dark right at sundown. So it seems to be saying you've got a brief window of time between sun going down and at dark. That's when the lamb was killed. And that's why, following Christ and his disciples' example, we start our Passover service right at sundown. We don't start it before sundown because that would be the 13th of the first month. So we started at the beginning of the 14th. And here he's making the point that there is a change. He's saying you have to come to the place where God puts his name. That would be the tabernacle in their time. It's there with them now on the plains of Moab. They're going to cross over the Jordan. They're going to set it up in Shiloh where it'll stay for a long time. Later, the place where God puts his name will be in Jerusalem. The important thing is, where did they slaughter the Passover when they were in Egypt? Yeah, at their homes, each person in their own home. So God is making a change here. Same sacrifice, but he's saying, come and do it at the place where I'll put my name. And I say it didn't change the timing of when it was killed, but he's changing where you go do it. Now, when they're wandering in the wilderness, they're all close to the tabernacle anyways, so it's not an issue. Again, a lot of what's said here is predicated on the fact that, okay, we're here, we're ready to cross the river, we're going to spread out and settle this land instead of all being grouped together. So when that happens, I'm telling you how to act afterwards. There's some question, though, some logistical challenges. If all these thousands or millions of people come to Jerusalem, can they all be at the temple sacrificing lambs all at once? You know, it's been a challenge. The rabbis came up with the solution that they said was right was they started saying between the evening started at noon and went until dark. And so during the time of Christ, apparently that's what was happening. People would come and they'd be cycling through the temple all afternoon. That might be the solution. To me, I find that somewhat unsatisfying. Others have said, well, you don't have to kill it and eat it there. You know, people come to Jerusalem. Some have said, you sacrifice, you're there where God put his name, not necessarily in the temple. Or others would say, come to the temple, slash its throat, then take it back to wherever you're staying, your hotel, your campground, your whatever. That also raises some questions. So the fact that there's questions doesn't mean that God's law doesn't say what it says. But this is one of the things that muddies the issue where people are looking at the Old Testament saying, well, when do they keep Passover? And people get confused about the start of the 15th, the start of the 14th. Is it during the day of the 14th? You know, I think our teaching is correct for the reasons we've gone over quite a few times. And so I just want to leave it there that there is that question. If you all have to come to Jerusalem, okay, there's some logistical challenges. Not insurmountable, but how they did surmount them, we have some questions about. Again, do we have that problem? No. We keep the Passover with the symbols that Jesus Christ instituted. We do come together in congregations, but there's in the current day, there's not one place where God puts his name. You know, we know that local congregations can set places, but this does support the idea that even though, I would say, if you're sick or for some reason you can't come to where the congregation is, you're able to take the Passover at home, but that should never be just a matter of convenience. God expects his people to come to where he puts his name. So that is the preference. Yes?
I find it odd that the last part says, at the time you came out of Egypt, because it's talking about the Passover, which is the day before, which is the evening before, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, but I think he's saying at the time, that general time, remember they started the Passover. Right. Matter of fact, we'll see, it becomes a little more clear as we go forward. There's another reference. But let's move ahead and get to that. Verse 8, 6 days you'll eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh there'll be a sacred assembly. So we realize that unleavened bread, the Bible clearly shows, is a seven-day festival that includes two holy days. The first day of unleavened bread, which is the 15th, is a holy day, and then the seventh day. And we understand if Passover is the 14th, that's not the 15th. As I said, 14 is not the same as 15. They're different days. Okay, so we're going to come back and revisit this, but he moves ahead to the next festival. Verses 9 through 12, he mentions, count 7 weeks for yourself, to count the 7 weeks, the time you begin to put the sickle to the grain. Pentecost, for this reason, is sometimes called the Feast of Weeks. So Pentecost means count 50. Feast of Weeks refers to counting 7 weeks. How do you count it? You know, well, back in Leviticus, there's Leviticus 23, there's a long description of the wave sheaf, which is done on the day after the Sabbath of unleavened bread. Now, you should be aware that many parts of the Jewish community keep the Pentecost on a set day because they say the Sabbath that you do the wave sheaf afterwards is the first holy day because that's an annual Sabbath. So that's why you'll see sometimes Jews, they're not keeping Pentecost the same time as we are. I'm pretty confident, and our church teaching is that that's not correct. And there's one good reason. If the Sabbath, that the day after the Sabbath that you kept the wave sheaf meant the day, the second day of unleavened bread, would you need to count? No, because you'd always be doing the wave sheaf on the 16th day of Abib, and so, you know, 50 days later would be a set day on the calendar. Instead of going through all this rigmarole about a wave sheaf and counting, he'd just say such and such date is always Pentecost. So that's why for us Pentecost is the one day that can shift around a little bit. It's always on Sunday because you're counting from the day after the weekly Sabbath. Yeah, actually the Hebrew that's used in Leviticus 23 supports that. And we covered it back then, so I'm not going to mention it again. But, of course, the way we keep it means that Pentecost always falls on a Sunday, so that's one time of the year that you know you're going to have two Sabbaths in a row. We happen to have two Sabbaths in a row at the end of the Days of Unleavened Bread, just by happenstance. But, you know, it's nice to have one. Usually it's the spring of the year, everybody's in a good mood. For some reason, you're happy to have two Sabbaths in a row by that time. Okay, let's move on. Starting in verse 13. Observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days when you've gathered from your threshing floor, your wine press. Rejoice at your feast. You, your son, your daughter, male servant, female servant, Levite, stranger, fatherless. I made the point that, okay, everybody gets to join in the feast. Now, because it mentions the Feast of Tabernacles here, doesn't mean that trumpets and atonement and the last great day are not holy days. As the next verse shows, God is focusing on the three seasons of the year that were holy days. And particularly back then, they would gather at Jerusalem. So one trip to the place where God puts his name would allow them to keep both Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. Then about a month and a half later, they can make a trip for Pentecost. And then one trip in the fall would let them to keep Atonement, Trumpets, you know, Feast of Tabernacles, and the Eighth Day. So he's focusing on the three times of the year. He leads it to Leviticus 23 to give the very specifics. Okay, and for verse 16, if you haven't heard this read 100 or more times, I'd be surprised. 3 times a year, that's what I was referring to. All your males shall appear before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses. Unleavened bread, Feast of Weeks, Feast of Tabernacles. Don't appear empty-handed. Every man give as he's able, according to the blessings of the Lord your God which he's given you. Okay, again, leaving further detail to back in Leviticus 23. The question comes up sometimes, okay, do only men have to go keep the feast keep the feast days? Can women decide, I'm tired of traveling, I want to stay home? I mean, for us now today, do we have anything in the Bible that tells us, no, women better keep it too? Yes, Charlie?
When Jesus and his parents were keeping Passover and Mary was among them.
Okay, so we've got an example. Certainly women can keep it. There's one other scripture I'm thinking that you want to make a connection with, Emily?
isn't there a verse that talks about, like, you and all who are within your gates that are supposed to go out, like, go have it with you?
Yeah, yeah, and you could say what I just read, you know, in verse 14, you know, you, your daughter, your male servant, your female, so that supports it. What I'm getting at is Galatians 3:28. For Christians, there is neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female. Okay, so male and female, we don't have the distinction. You know, for us, circumcision isn't a spiritual requirement, even though it's a good health measure. But remember, Colossians 2:11-12 says the circumcision without hands, the circumcision of Christ, is baptism. Men and women can be baptized. And if there's neither male nor female, Jew nor Greek, women are obligated to keep these feast days too. So that's, I want to realize some of these laws that were set up for the physical nation of Israel, you know, we have a broader implication for us. It's not just the men, just the heads of households. All of us have an individual covenant with God that we want to follow through and keep these days. And you're used to that from our practice. But I just want you to understand the underlying, you know, reason. We can look in the Bible and say, yeah, this is why we tell our women to do it too. Okay, one other thing I wanted to mention about the giving the offering. Offerings are based on blessing. How much do you have to give if you're blessed? What does it specify? Okay, what you're able according to your blessings. It's up to you to decide. If your blessings are not in financial, you might not be able to give as much. Like I said, if you have a lot of children, you might think, boy, I'm blessed, but I got to spend a bunch of money taking care of my children. I can't put as much in the basket. So there's a distinction. Whereas tithing, is there an amount specified for tithing? Yeah, it's 10%. It's always 10%. Now, 10% of a little is less than 10% of a lot. But the way I've heard some ministers in the past say, when you tithe, it just shows that you're obeying the law and not stealing from God. You know, it's obey or don't obey. Giving an offering, it is up to you and you have to think about. And we all go through that. And, you know, I've had times in my life where I could give more and times when I could give less. And we connect it with Corinthians where Paul says God loves a cheerful giver. So don't give so much that you can't be cheerful about it. So I'm just making the distinction. You know, how much to give as an offering has a different criteria than how much to give for a tithe. Okay, and there's a bit of a break here. I'm not going to stop, fortunately. I'm behind where I wanted to go. But starting with verse 18 of Deuteronomy 16, I'm making a point again. The scholars who consider that a lot of Deuteronomy expands on the Ten Commandments would say that the next section is expanding on the fifth commandment, which is honor your father and your mother. Okay, and I'll give you the parameters because it starts here with Deuteronomy 16, verse 18, and goes through Deuteronomy 18, verse 22, which, you know, obviously the people who divided this into chapter and verse sometime hundreds of years ago didn't see this, that as being what Deuteronomy was doing. So again, it's for informational purposes. But if it is an expansion, we'll note that it's looking not only at honoring your parents, but expanding it to different types of authority figures. The people of human authority, actually, we could break it down. It matches what we saw back in Zephaniah chapter 3, verses 3 and 4. I think I actually had a question on the test about this, of who God condemned for not leading properly. The four I've got listed are prophets, priests, kings, and judges. Or princes, it's described there. The prophets were responsible for conveying God's message. The priests, responsible for instructing in God's word and leading in worship. Kings were responsible for setting up and administering civil government. And then judges slash officers slash princes, you could put those together in whatever combination you like, they're responsible for carrying out and enforcing the laws. So God's going to address all of these as people that we should honor and respect. And you could see that as an extension of honoring your parents, which is the authority in a family. So I see it there. There are some individual scriptures here and there that it might seem a switch. But he starts off, you know, verse 18, Appoint judges and officers in all your gates, which the Lord gives you. Why gates? Well, in ancient times, that's where government, you know, and public business was done. And they'll judge the people. Verse 19, here's addressing those judges. Don't pervert justice. Don't show partiality. Don't take a bribe. That matches with what we read in the book of James, and I don't have the exact scripture, but remember, God hates partiality. A bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous. Rather, verse 20, follow what's altogether just, that you may live and inherit the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Okay, God supports having civil government and officers in authority, but those officers and those government officials should act from principle, not respect of persons. You can, I've got the distinction here. We know that the church of God is not a civil government. The church is a community of those called out, and we obey God's laws. But as I said, we don't go around enforcing the traffic regulations, the tax code, or any of that other stuff. But we do teach that we should obey the laws of the land where we live. I don't have the scripture written down. I think Romans 13, I think, is where Paul makes that case. Not the only place, but yeah, Romans 13, verses 1 through 7 is a good place. Now, since we don't have to worry about enforcing those laws, you could ask the question, why are we studying this Old Testament law? Why should we as Christians care about it? Any thoughts? Nate? He might reenact it in the millennium. What's that to us? I'm not saying to be critical. There's an answer that in the millennium, do we need to know the law that God's going to set up? Okay. If we're teachers, maybe kings and priests, whatever law, you know, whether it's this law or it's a different set, we're probably going to be responsible for administering it, or we're likely to be. So we need to understand how God thinks a government should work. It's worth our while to understand the principles of governing and law enforcement that God has in his mind. Yes, Emily?
More simply than that, a purpose of why we still need to know it is because he put it in here for a reason. Whether or not we specifically know that reason, even if it was just for lessons to learn in our everyday lives, he put it here for us to read.
I'll buy that. Yeah. Was it 2 Timothy 3:16? All scripture is inspired by God and profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, instruction, and righteousness. I'm not sure if I quoted that exactly right, but I think part of the reason, as I said, he could reinstitute this very law or something similar to it. So we want to, it's worth having a little bit of legal thinking as far as that goes. Having said that, let's move on. I haven't finished the chapter. Verses 21 and 22. Don't plant yourself tree as a wooden image near the altar. Don't set up a sacred pillar. God didn't want anywhere near his temple these groves and images that were used by the pagans to worship. And why is it included here when we started talking about government? Perhaps, and I'm only saying perhaps because God doesn't explain why, but perhaps it's to make the point that even your rulers don't have the right to overrule God's instruction for how to worship. So he set up the priesthood, and later he'll establish the kingdom. The king doesn't have the right to tell the priest, I'm changing what you're doing. You know, God set up the worship, and he didn't want any sacred pillars and any idols or groves, you know, added into his worship. And again, that applies to us. So again, we look at what God says, how to obey and worship him. You know, the local mayor in Milford can't decide to overrule that. And we as ministers don't really have the responsibility. Sometimes we have a responsibility to interpret how we do it in our modern setting. For instance, yes, the questions come up. We just covered the 3 times a year given offering. We do it on 7 occasions within 3 seasons. That's an administrative decision. It's not violating what it said, but it's going a little further. But that's just something, you know. But I don't think it'd be right for us to say, we're just not going to take up an offering, or we're going to do it every week. That's not fitting within. Anyways, let's move on. I was hoping to get through chapter 17, which might not well do, but although he starts off, Don't sacrifice to the Lord your God a bull or sheep which has a blemish or defect. Not only must idolatry be avoided, but God's worship must be done properly. No half-hearted efforts. You know, this implies that some people might keep the best livestock for themselves because I really like that good Angus steak and I don't want to sacrifice that at the temple. God's saying, no defect stuff. Defective stuff given to God. If there's found among you within any of your gates which the Lord gives you, a man or woman who has been wicked, gone and served other gods, as it says in verse 3, and it's told you, hear of it, then you inquire diligently. Okay, so we don't just go on hearsay, we do an investigation to make sure, but God's government, he says, does have the right to enact the death penalty. Verse 5, bring out of your gates that man or woman who's committed the wicked thing and stone him with stones. Verse 6, whoever is deserving of death shall be put to death. But here's where we said, on the testimony of two or three witnesses, not just one. And the hands of the witnesses shall be first against him. So the civil government does have the authority to enact the death penalty only after a proper investigation, only with at least two witnesses. And those witnesses have to put their money where their mouth is, so to speak. They have to be willing to throw the first stones. That would encourage them to take the matter seriously. It's like, yeah, sure, David's wicked. Go kill him. No, it's like, I got to think he's wicked enough. I'm willing to take a stone, you know. Hopefully that would deter that. And I'll remind you, studies show that most often stoning wasn't done just by throwing rocks. It was often throwing them off of a ledge or down on a hard place and then finishing them off with stones. But that's subject to, you know, that's the predominance of history supports that. But there's room to argue whether it was always done that way. Okay, verses 8 through 13 seems to be instruction for the local officers and judges. If a matter arises which is too hard for you to judge, and it describes that, later in verse 8, then you shall arise and go up to the place which the Lord your God chooses. Come before the priests, the Levites, and the judge which is in those days, and they'll pronounce judgment on you. And you shall do according to the sentence they pronounce. You shall be careful to do according to what they order you, according to the sentence of the law. So this isn't saying that the individual who's on trial has the right to appeal, but if the local officers aren't sure, they should take it up the line, so to speak, appeal to a higher authority. And that this matches with what Moses instituted when he set up that pyramid system of captains of tens, captains of 50s, hundreds, thousands. He said that the small matters you decide, the tougher matters bring up to someone of higher authority. And eventually, if it came all the way to Moses, he'd go ask God. Now, that's sort of saying this, okay, if the local officials aren't sure how to rule, they can go to Jerusalem, and there's what we could see is sort of a supreme court. The priests, the Levites, and if there's a judge at the time, maybe it was Gideon or Samson, whoever would participate, and they would make a decision. And it seems to be saying there's no appeal from that. You know, whatever they tell you to do when you do that, you got to do. It's the judgment is final. So that indicates God expected his government to be obeyed. Verse 12, the man who acts presumptuously and will not heed the priest who stands to minister, that man shall die, and you'll put away evil. And verse 13, all the people will hear and fear and no longer act presumptuously. So again, God means business of what he says. Okay. Moving on to still in government. Verse 14, when you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you and you say, I think I'll set up a king like the other nations have. Well, you shall surely set up a king over you, but whom the Lord your God chooses. So you might choose a king, but you're not just going to have an election. God's going to choose. And it has to be someone from among your brethren, no foreigner. There's some interesting things we could say about that. And by the way, God is anticipating what did happen. There's a reference in 1 Samuel 8, verses 4 through 7. And you went through the story. Remember, they came to Samuel. Samuel, your sons aren't following in your ways. Give us a king like the other nations. And Samuel was upset because he realized God was supposed to be their king. But finally, God told Samuel, they haven't rejected you. They rejected me. And I'm going to send you. And you know, first, God makes Saul king. Saul gets full of himself and gets disqualified. God would choose David. Now, it says it has to be of their brethren. we could ask the question, does that mean no one who has a mixed ancestry could ever be king? I see shaking heads. Well, how do we know that? Okay, you know, we know David had a mixed ancestry, and thus so did Jesus Christ. Now, I'll warn you, out there, not only in society, but in the church, you'll encounter people who will say, I don't think that's true. I think Rahab was an Israelite who somehow got separated and was brought in. And the same for Tamar. And Ruth wasn't really a Moabite. She was an I've heard these arguments, and I don't think they hold water. And I don't think that's what God is saying here. I'd say, you know, okay, you're an Israelite if you're an Israelite. You know, David wasn't a half Moabite, whatever. He was an Israelite. Yeah, he had Canaanite and Moabite in his ancestry, but having some mix does, you know, I don't think that's what God meant to disqualify someone. What he meant is, instead of David, they couldn't send over to the Philistines and say, send us your king to be our king. Which, by the way, in medieval Europe, during the feudal era, that did happen at times. But we're not going to get into that. God didn't want his kings to emulate that of the others. Verses 16 and 17. Didn't want him building up wealth. There we go. He shall not multiply horses for himself, or cause the people to return to Egypt or multiply horses. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself. Why? Lest his heart turn away and he greatly multiply, or nor shall he multiply gold and silver. Okay, do we have an example of what happens? Nate. Solomon did exactly these things that he was told not to. He started off very wise. He did some foolish things, and those wives turned him away, his heart from God. Now, I like to believe that what we read in Ecclesiastes was Solomon nearer the end of his life realizing that he'd done wrong and trying to change things. But there's still a question about that. Okay, so horses are not entirely forbidden, but building up great military strength was. And the king wasn't to have a harem. Basically, one wife should be enough for anybody. Believe me. You could imply, though, it seems that that might also be a way of preventing political alliances. Because through the ages, often one nation would make an alliance to another by having my son, this king's son, marry that king's daughter. And so, or I, you know, Solomon married the daughter of Pharaoh, then he married, you know, so basically I marry all these other kings' wives, you know, and if you're willing to have 700 wives, you can have all you want. It's not only building a harem, it's also, as I said, alliances. And God didn't want that. I'm trying to decide if I can get to the, well, let's summarize. I know I'm going a little bit over. But verses 18 through 20 basically says, when you have this king, he's got to write himself a copy of this law. And that the law he means is what we're reading right here. Some people would debate, does it mean just Deuteronomy? Does it mean Genesis through Deuteronomy? You know, does it mean that the statutes of Exodus 21, 23, 24? We're not certain, but the king's supposed to get his own copy of the law. Study it and read it. So he borrows the scroll that's there at the tabernacle, later temple, writes his own copy, I guess gives that copy back. So he borrows it out of the library, makes himself a copy, and goes on. The idea is he's supposed to know the law. And I know education theory has shown if you write something out, it gets into your head much more than if you just read it. So write it out, read it, reread it, study it. God wanted the king to know his law inside and out. Yeah, and at the very end of the verse, there's one other comment I'll make, and then we'll take a break. It says that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. Some people think that that note of and his children is a way of God saying he believes in a hereditary monarchy, which we see a hereditary monarchy did exist, especially in David's line that God promised would always exist. But, you know, some people would say, well, just because you have kids doesn't mean they're qualified to be king in your place. And many times that's true. Actually, in Rome, you know, a lot of the Caesars would adopt someone, you know, not their own children, because they might, my kid's inept. I don't want him to be Caesar. Let's go get this other guy. Of course, oftentimes they'd be inept too. Whew. Sorry, I stretched it. I wanted to get the end of that chapter. Any questions, thoughts, concerns?